Welcome to Goshen Books. Hi, I'm Leanne Grunberg Wakabayashi here in Jerusalem.
I'm thrilled today to present to you Rebecca Ottawa, who's lived in Japan for 40 years and counting. And she is the author of three wonderful books, At Home in Japan, essays that were published by Tuttle in 2010. And that book was really a trailblazer in breaking open to many foreigners in Japan the possibility of writing about their stories, however off the beaten track they were. So I personally was inspired by Rebecca's story and her ability to mix art and writing in everything she does. That first book had wonderful illustrations, handmade illustrations that she did. And this was followed by a children's book, My Awesome Japan Adventure, a children's book published by Tuttle in 2013. And more recently, The Mad Kyoto Shoe Swapper of 2019, which again plays off Rebecca's whimsical, quirky side. And this is something that is so lovable about Rebecca, that she has this ability to express herself in a ways that sees beyond what meets the eye and makes sense of it and interprets it for us in Japan and beyond. She has also painted over 50 pictures of various genres and held two shows. And I'm very pleased today to welcome Rebecca Ottawa.
Thank you very much, Leanne, and thank you for inviting me, and thank you everybody who decided to come. Thank you so much.
It's exciting to see new and old friends here. It's always exciting to realize that, Rebecca, you are a member of a longtime writers community that wasn't here when you first came to Japan 40 years ago, I'm presuming. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess so. I certainly didn't know anything about it. I wrote for a closed circulation journal, which was published by the Association of Foreign Wives of Japanese, and that was pretty much my only writing outlet for many years. This was before the internet and, you know, all that stuff.
And that magazine is still in existence today. And
oh, yeah.
It really was like the spark that ignited a lot of women who were married to Japanese initiated them into the field of writing. And how would you say that's changed today now with the Kyoto Writers Group and many, many other outlets as far as connecting you? Did you ever imagine that you would have a worldwide audience? I should ask you that.
Well, no. And I think that the fact that we now have all these wonderful tools at our disposal means that we can get to know people better and get to know more people. And our circle has certainly widened incredibly. And I have to also thank the, trailblazers such as the Kyoto Journal and also the Japan Writers Conference and many other people who have organizations and people who have made it easier for people who write to have a voice. And I think it's everybody's very, very grateful for that.
I'd like to just introduce a little bit about Rebecca's inspiration for a lot of what she does. She lives in the Shiga countryside. In 1986, she and her husband and her young sons moved back to her husband Toshiro's ancestral home in Shiga, ready to become the 19th generation to take occupancy of a 350-year-old samurai farmhouse in the countryside near Kyoto. Rebecca has lived there ever since, raising her two boys, writing books, drawing, gardening, participating in village life, and communing with her cats and other creatures. So Rebecca, I'd like to ask you to begin with a reading from At Home in Japan.
And the one I'm going to read is kind of a, well, I guess it's in a way whimsical. My house talking. This is the voice of the house talking. Anyway, this little story is called The House Speaks. The stoves have been turned off, and I feel the heat gradually leave me as the new one's footsteps die away down the stone path. The clock ticks softly. There is no other sound but the occasional whisper of cats settling on the chairs or moving sinuously through the gaps in the sliding doors. I am without human occupation this day. It is a perfect time to feel my own feelings and think my own thoughts. The new one is the heir's wife, the present custodian. I call her the new one because she has a certain kind of energy that I have never felt before in all the generations of humans I have sheltered. She often goes out, but she almost always returns the same day. Even when she is gone, I can feel her bond, the strength of her vow. She and the heir are going to take care of me. They have sworn it. I am safe for another generation. I am one of the lucky ones. All around me, houses my age or even younger are suffering the pain and indignity of being reduced to a heap of gray wood, splinters of bamboo, plaster dust, and broken tiles. Even the stones, which proudly once held up the pillars, are dug out of the earth and taken away. In place of the previous old house, the occupants, who are usually the original families, people who belong here, who don't come from outside, put up some kind of new structure. I would hesitate to call it a house, with no verandas, no tatami, no beams, no roof tiles. The wood struts are woefully puny and insubstantial. I know these neighborhood upstarts won't last, not as I have lasted. I miss the old houses. They were my neighbors, my fellows, my friends. Of course, I cannot count the winters that have passed since I began my life. The heir has tried. He is very interested in numbers, but the blessing papers from the shrine put into the rafters at the time of my building are no longer readable. Still, he estimates I have stood considerably more than 300 winters. And the original family has lived under my roof for at least 16 generations. Let those flimsy, chemical-ridden structures around me try to beat that record. It's no wonder I have lasted so long with the good, strong materials that went into me. The largest piece of wood in my structure is the huge cross beam carved from a single tree trunk and stretching through living room, kitchen, and breezeway. It's about 12 meters long and has a cross section of almost 40 centimeters in the new measurement system they use these days. There's an interesting story about this beam. When it was cut from the forest and carried to this site, at a certain point, it had to turn a corner in the town, but it was too long. There was no way the humans could make it go around the corner. So they decided to break down the earthen temple wall on the corner to allow the passage of the beam. The wall was later rebuilt with many apologies. They broke a temple wall rather than shorten that beam. I feel very proud when I consider that. It's a sign that my family was real quality. When I was first built, I took the same form as most houses in this area. There were four rooms arranged in a square with raised floors. Another sign of quality. Most homes had mainly dirt floors in those days. Surrounded by wooden verandas and an attached roofed kitchen area. One of the rooms had a fire pit or hearth and a hole in the roof above, covered, of course, to let the smoke out. My new beams and pillars were painted with Bengara, a red iron oxide pigment mixed with charcoal, to make the soft, dark, purplish-brown color that the occupants liked and to discourage insects. Time after time, I felt the soothing rub of cloth bags filled with rice germ to bring up the shine of my wood, and damp cloths to remove dust. I was like a thoroughbred horse, a very long-lived one, lovingly cleaned and curried by generations of hands. Since then, my rooms have increased and I have had new roofs and new floors. Many members of the original family have come and gone. I have been witness to times of pain and grief and times of happiness and celebration. There were births, marriages, and deaths all under my roof. I am proud to have sheltered them faithfully and they in turn have dedicated themselves to my well-being. Now the present occupants are here. The heir is very proud of me, and he has taught his children to be proud too. I think I can feel sure that these children will honor me when their turn comes. As for the wife, the new one, she comes from so far away I can't even imagine it. She has made some interesting changes. There's a strange kind of colored glass window in the entryway now, and inside there are some new wood floors, to say nothing of the furniture, chairs, the like of which I've never seen, spotlights in the ceiling, glass tiles in the kitchen roof to let in more light. Her voice is different, and her motions and rhythms are too, but she takes care of me, sweeping and polishing as best she can, and she loves me. I can feel her heart. I know she will stay. Was that the car door slamming? Were those footsteps on the stones? Ah, you see, here she is, back from her outing. I will be warm again.
Beautiful. Rebecca, when we spoke at an earlier meeting, you said that you were looking, when you were first in Japan, for a book that was like this. You wanted a story that would kind of inform your personal experience of living the countryside, but what you were finding were mostly books about Tokyo or city life.
That's for sure. Of course, that was a long time ago, but even now, I think that many, many of the books that you'll see where it says books on Japan in the bookstore are still books about city life. I won't say Tokyo, but city life in general. There aren't very many books that have been published about country life. There was an anthology out a couple of years ago called Inaka, which was an anthology published by Camphor Press. I had an essay in that anthology about changes in my neighborhood in the past 40 years. It was mostly about changes and about, like many countries, I think a lot of old countries are like this. The rural areas are so, so different from the city. In so many ways, it's impossible to even list them, particularly social ways and the way people relate to each other, very, very different. So I wanted to write something about that.
Rebecca, were you raised in a city environment or a country environment?
I think I'd have to say suburban. I was born in Orange County, California, that hotbed of whatever, anyway. It was right near Disneyland. We moved into one of the new suburbs that was made around the Disneyland area. And it was a brand new house. We moved into it when it was new. There weren't any old houses in the neighborhood that I knew about. They were all the same age. And then in Australia, I was also living in a kind of a suburban environment, inner city suburb in Brisbane. So I didn't really have very much connection with the countryside myself until I came to this house.
So it wasn't that you had some kind of fairy tale longing to live in an old house, did you?
No, but what I did have and what I always had was a desire to grow things. I think I was probably the only person in my family who was interested in planting seeds and seeing what would come up. And I always did that, even from a very, very small child. So when I got here and I saw all this land, I thought, whoopee, now I can grow whatever I want.
That's great. Can I open up to anyone questions? If you would like to ask a question, just raise your hand and then unmute yourself. Yes, Mark?
Hi, Rebecca. Great to see
Hi.
You.
Hi. Nice to see you, too.
Actually, I was going to ask you about this book you were just talking about. I haven't had a chance to see or read Inaka yet.
Oh,
but
right.
The essay that you contributed, in which you documented the changes in your neighborhood over the past 40 years, would you be able to give us just a thumbnail sketch or summary of what some of those changes might have been?
Okay, well, as most people know, the Japanese countryside, like many other countrysides in the world, is suffering from a very intense depopulation. There are many, many fewer people in the village than there used to be. People are having fewer children. And also, one thing that really struck me very hard was that in our village alone, there used to be about a dozen shops. Now there is not one shop left. They're all gone. There was the tofu-san, the futon-san, and the sakana-san, and the blah, 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 all different shops right within walking distance of our home. And now you have to go, in order to get to a shop, you have to go, oh, I guess 5 minutes by car to get to the closest shop. And that means that, of course, the population is also aging, because very few young people want to come back here to live. So that means that the older people, they don't have anywhere to buy things. They don't have any way to go shopping if they're by themselves, and a lot of them can't drive. And I think that's a really painful change that I have seen in the time I've lived here, is all these shops closing one after another.
Marion has a question. Yes.
Okay.
I have a question. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi.
The first time I met you was when you sold me your book.
Oh.
In Tokyo. At an AFWJ event, and I enjoyed reading it so much.
Thank you so much.
I'm wondering about young people in your village, because I think this is something that's a big story all over Japan about young people not wanting to stay there. Your son has come back, and I wonder what the situation is in general in your area for young people. Are they still committed to that life, or are they moving away?
Well, I think that it all depends on what kind of life a person wants to have. If a person has a dream of being, say, a famous musician or something like that, obviously they have to leave. We had a very interesting event in our, I guess it must have been more than 2 years ago now. It was called People Who Come Here From Somewhere Else. And a lot of the people were like U-turn people, people who left and then came back. In fact, our local, not the mayor, a kind of a, anyway, government representative, one of the representatives in our local government was like that. He went to Tokyo, got married, had little kids, decided it wasn't for him, and decided to come back, and he found himself a house and, you know, did that. And there are people who come, they find houses, you know, on various online sites and or by word of mouth, and they come back here and live. There are also many, many what I'd like to call foreigners that Hino, my town, is one of the most, has a, the one of the largest foreign populations in the Shiga prefecture. Which isn't really saying terribly much, but it is kind of interesting. I really didn't think there were that many. But those people also, and also there have been a lot of people come to, you know, they feel like country life is better, so they've come, they've decided that they want to start a country life, and they've come to this area. Because it's close to places. It's only a couple hours from Osaka. It's only an hour from Kyoto, a couple hours from Nagoya. So it's in a very good, it's not way to hell and gone up in, you know, Hokkaido or Aomori or somewhere. It's a place where, it, you know, you can get to places that are relatively, if you don't mind driving a little bit or getting on the train, you can do things. It's a little bit easier, so. I should also just very quickly mention that my son and his family moved back into our house at the beginning of last year. And they made many changes, and I was kind of hoping that they would stay, but apparently his company is going to send him somewhere else next year, so I guess they'll all go off again, leaving the house completely different, but, you know, back to normal in the sense that I'll be the only one there.
Which, Rebecca, do you like that, being the only one there?
Oh, God, yeah. I love being alone. I just want everyone to leave all the time. I'm like, when are you leaving next? You know, and it's very sad. My husband says, well, you're always asking me when I'm going on my next business trip. It's very irritating.
Oh, no wonder you love your grandchildren.
The grandchildren are great. Yeah. No question.
Sure.
Of course, I'm not saying that any of them isn't great, but it's just a big change to be alone for basically 10 years, because my husband was gone for more than half the year, for 10 years on business, and suddenly to have six people in the family, it's an awful lot of people to get used to just all at once.
How many rooms are there in the house, Rebecca?
Geez. I don't know. One, two, three, four. Yeah, well, there's a lot of renovation going on, but I'm okay, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I don't know, about 15 altogether, I suppose.
Yeah. Okay. So we're not talking city life. This is something important to kind of wrap our heads around.
Yeah.
That many rooms.
Although where we live now in the inside the house is much smaller because, you know, I gave the main part of the house to the younger people because they have more people to worry about. So we're mm-hmm. sort of living in the granny flat, which is relatively small.
All right, let's hear more from your book. I'm excited to have you read on.
Okay, well, I'd like to read a story about my relationships with people in the village. I was in a kind of a funny situation because when I got married, my mother-in-law, her idea of me being a asset to the family was that I should become as Japanese as possible, as quickly as possible. And in order to do that, she introduced me to her friends, the friends of her generation. She was not an old lady. When I met her first, she was only 47 years old. The people that I thought of as my friends then turned out to be her generation of old people. And I have to say that since this book was published in 2010, a lot of these people are no longer around, but still, I'd like to read them because it gives a sort of a flavor of what life used to be like for me when I was a younger person living here. I'm talking about my friends. This is called the Vegetable Patch. One of my best friends in the village is an old lady I'll call Oba-chan, Auntie. She's 80, if a day, small and wiry, with a frizz of pepper and salt hair, a few crooked teeth, and shrewd, merry eyes. Her voice is loud and her movements are definite. Like many old ladies around here, she has effectively retired from the group of women who are required to efface themselves modestly. She's really more like a man. Now I'm a member of that group too, yay. Oba-chan is one of a handful of old ladies in the village who battle their various infirmities to work their vegetable patches. Some of them send produce to far-flung family members or sell it at the local farmers' markets, but mostly it's a way to maintain their view of themselves as productive human beings. Increasingly, their efforts are ignored by daughters-in-law who prefer supermarket veggies that are uniform in size and don't have dirt still sticking to them. But these old aunties persevere because they are of the thrifty old school that can't stand to see a perfectly good piece of land going to waste. Another good motivation, of course, is that the vegetable patch is where they can meet with each other regularly and have a good chat. Oba-chan is a welcome and important part of my life. She comes to help me with my endless weeding chores or to collect garden trash after the tree trimmers have finished in the garden. While she works, she talks. I can ask her anything and she's not shy about replying. From her, I learned such village lore as why the owner of the local grocery store committed suicide, an incurable illness, and why the middle-aged unmarried son of the roofer torched his dad's truck in the middle of the night. He's not right in the head. Both of those stories appeared in my Mad Kyoto Shoeswapper book. I wrote them as stories. From her, I learned the meaning of my latest dream about my mother-in-law and the preferred method of making certain pickles. Oba-chan is a perfect mine of information on just about any subject related to everyday life in the village. She's full of judgments, but somehow I don't feel any malice emanating from her. It's just that she has definite opinions and isn't afraid to voice them. I'm glad that her opinion of me is good. Actually, I'm lucky to have the goodwill of many old village ladies. This came about partly because my own mother-in-law, who was relatively young but full of family pride, took my wifely education very seriously. She tutored me rigorously in village etiquette. Her contemporaries saw her efforts and also mine and approved. From what my mother-in-law told them, she never belittled me in public. As far as they could see, I was an ideal daughter-in-law. Easy to mold since I knew nothing, and also polite, tractable, and obedient. Of course, the extra cachet of being a gaijin, foreigner, outsider, upped the stakes in the endurance department for both my mother-in-law and me. Commiseration is one of the main oils that grease the wheels in Japanese society, and tales of hardship and woe, which in the West would elicit comments like, why do you put up with that? Receive the acclamation, taihen desu ne, that's a lot to bear. The Oba-chans I know have been through the ringer. Also, by great good fortune, I have a love of gardening and feel deep satisfaction in growing my own vegetables, however haphazardly. The vegetable patch itself provides an inexhaustible fund of conversation and gives the aunties a chance to pass on knowledge that their own daughters-in-law mostly aren't interested in. This is another point in my favor. These old aunties have seen a lot in their day: war, depression, upheaval, shortages, and modernization. Perhaps most poignantly, they have seen society itself shift paradigms so that they lost out twice. When they were young, age was respected and youth wasn't important. Now that they are old, age is pushed aside in favor of the young. The contributions of aged people to the community, wisdom, maturity, experience, and calm, are not valued as they used to be. With this shift has come a change in their status within their families. As young wives themselves, they probably had to endure harsh demands and scolding from older women. But now they find themselves tiptoeing around trying to stay in the family's good graces. They fear being consigned to the old age home. They fear being a bother when they get ill. And they fear not being remembered with respect and affection after they are gone. Sometimes I dare to imagine they are happy that a slightly younger person like me should enjoy a chat with them and ask their advice. In general, the people in the village treat me with circumspection after these few decades. They know me, they see me on the street, and we exchange greetings. We may be in the same volunteer group or share communal tasks, such as cleanup time at the shrine, but most of their social life is opaque to me. I don't know enough to be a good gossiper, and that means I'm almost entirely oblivious to any gossip about me. I pull my weight in village tasks, and beyond that, I think for most of them, I'm just part of the landscape. Excuse me. The men don't really see women anyway. The women my age have shared children's upbringing, school, and PTA with me, but because of my relatively old-fashioned wifely apprenticeship, I suspect I have been thrown up to them by their own mothers-in-law. If Rebecca-san can do it, why can't you? Which probably doesn't endure them to me. To most of the children, I'm just a familiar oddity. The Oba-chans are the ones I can really relate to. The vegetable patch sure will be lonely when they are gone. And it is.
Beautiful.
Those people are gone. Sorry, I made a few mistakes because I've got a kitty cat jumping around my ankles. I am distracting, sorry.
That was written more than 10 years ago, Rebecca. And would you say what you write feels so relevant today?
Well, I think it's true. And the really amazing thing that I'm starting to feel the exact same way myself. I was sat on by my mother-in-law, and now I can't say boo to my own daughter-in-law. You know, exactly the same as those old ladies. It's a very funny situation, really.
Interesting.
It's called, this is how karma comes around in your very same lifetime. It's kind of like, woo, where did that come from?
Right. Any questions?
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Jan.
Hey, Gary.
Hey, good how to are speak. You?
Good. I just wondered if you, if your three books that have been published so far, well, four with the anthologies, they're quite different from each other. Do you have a fifth one in mind or that you're working on?
Yes, I think I'm finally ready to write an actual memoir without sort of, you know, closing everything up in cute little essays. I'm going to write the real thing this time. I don't know if I'm publishing it, but I'm going to write it. I already started.
Excellent. Love to read it. And it'll have illustrations, of course.
Yeah. The main thing that I'm a little bit worried about is that I spent so many years of my life learning how to live in this house. And I know so many different things. And it's like, now what do I do? Because it's all so different now. People don't do the sort of things that I've learned how to do. Can you excuse me one moment? Oh, saying goodnight.
Good night.
Okay, see you tomorrow. All right. It's hard to kind of know where one is in this kind of situation. The vanishing culture, and here are all these things that I know, which probably the next generation won't care about at all, to say nothing of the generation after that. And it's like, are these things really worth keeping, or are they all destined to be swept away? I mean, think of all the things that have been swept away in this world as new generations come up and say, we don't need that anymore. We don't want that anymore. And boom, 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 it's gone. Yeah. And it's getting faster all the time. I guess you have to just try to hold on to the universal constants of life, which is hard to do when, you know, people around you are sort of going, well, I'm not interested in that. I don't see the point of that anymore, kind of, man.
Could I,
Marian?
Rebecca, could you go into a little bit more detail there about some of the things that you feel are not being valued anymore that you feel sad about?
Well, okay. One of the things that I find very hard to bear is the waste that goes on in this society, and the country people are no different. There's this incredible amount of, because my mother-in-law was a very, very thrifty person. She always saved everything because you never know when this is going to come in handy, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I had to get rid of a lot of things because, you know, I have new people in the house. They all had their own nimotsu and everything. So a lot of the things that I was saving, I had to throw away. And then a few months later, I was like, oh, what happened to that old sheet? You know, what happened to this? What happened to that? And I realized that, you know, that kind of thriftiness is really very important in life. You say, oh, you can always buy a new one, but increasingly this is going to get more and more difficult to save things that may be useful later is a kind of a way of thinking that I think has really gone by the board, and especially when people don't have very much space to save things, that's a problem, of course. We've always had a lot of space, so it's easy to save, you know, mountains of, you know, towels or whatever.
Any other questions before we move on? Ed?
Yes, Ed.
I have your little, your book that you were just reading from. I have a copy when we met in Kobe at the
Yes.
Writers Conference.
Yes, I remember.
Gave some inspiration for me in my writing, but I just wanted to tell you that there's some images in that book that I still remember every time at night when I get out of the bath, and I remember the little essay where you talk about being the last one in the bath and opening the window. And the story of the kotatsu with what comes out from underneath the kotatsu, the heating table, you know, the socks and the things.
Yeah. Some things that fall down in there and then you have to get them out. It's kind of surprising.
I just wanted to tell you that for me, some of those images really stuck with me.
Thank you.
It's been a long time since I read the book. I still have it. And also you're reading about the grannies, because of course I write about the grannies, and it was very nice to hear.
God bless them.
A woman writing about grannies, and a little bit different, and it brought back the memories of some of my grannies who are not around anymore.
Mm.
And as to someone else's question.
I miss them, I do.
And the other thing that I like to ask any memoir or story writers, when will you write your second one? So somebody already asked that question, but I'm always curious. Someone who's written one book about their life in Japan, if and when they're going to write the next one, and you know what they're going to do different, same, or whatever. So that's just wanted to say that.
That's a very interesting point, and I often think, how can somebody write their memoir when they're only halfway through with their life? You don't know what's going to happen, or you don't know how you're going to feel about things later. The way I felt was when I wrote that book, I hope nobody takes this the wrong way. I felt like all the love and fascination I had for Japan went straight into that book. It's no longer in my head. It's gone. This is my home. And yeah, I live in Japan, but it's not like I'm constantly thinking about Japanese things every minute of the day, you know. I mean, this is my life, and you know, I have to do various things, and some things are, I'm very glad because I live in Japan, and other times I'm sort of unhappy to be here. But it's life, isn't it? You just keep on going. Thank you, Ed, for that.
Well, that's a very good answer. A very good answer. Thank you. Very helpful. I mean, I can relate, and I'm sure there's some other people.
Anybody who's written something, or even if you haven't, you know, write something now. Write your truth.
Exactly. Thank you.
Yes, Mary?
Yeah, that's something maybe not now, maybe later on, but I think of this. This is such a beautifully produced book. And I
at home in Japan.
Yeah, it's beautifully produced. Like the end papers are just gorgeous.
Oh yeah,
the paper is wonderful. The font and everything. And I'm kind of interested to know how the whole process, how easy that was to get it the way you wanted, or that kind of process.
Yeah.
Do we have time? Because
I'll just say really quickly.
Sure.
The book started off as a completely different book. It was it was written on large sketch paper. It was handwritten. It had color illustrations, and it was set up as from January to December, three essays each. But nobody would publish it. Maybe it's nothing to be wondered at, because the handwriting changes in five. It took me 5 years to write, so the handwriting wasn't any, what was different from the beginning to the end. And, you know, it was very variable in quality. So Taro gave me an opportunity. They said, we'll be happy to publish your book, but we want to change it this way, A, B, C, D. And I had to choose between the illustrations and the writing. Which did I think was more important? And I chose the writing. And in that case, they said, okay, well, we can't have color illustrations, going to make them black and white. And the book is, as it stands, is too short. You have to write a little bit more. So I wrote a whole bunch more. And then they asked me to shuffle the essays around into topics rather than by month. So that was a change as well. And I fulfilled their stipulations that they made. And aside from that, they gave me a lot of leeway with regards to the actual look of the book, except for the front cover photograph, which I still don't like at all. But anyway, that is not a house. That is a ryokan.
Rebecca, for people who don't know what a ryokan is, tell us. Well, it's a definition.
It's an entranceway that looks a lot more like a Japanese inn than like a regular. It certainly doesn't look like my entranceway at all. So when I saw it, I thought, oh my God, where did they get that? Because I sent them a whole bunch of pictures, and even ukiyo-e that I found that I thought was really cute. But they didn't like those. They wanted to use their own. So that was really the only thing that sort of made me go, oh man, you know, with regards to that book.
Rebecca, they're very clever. That book has gone into 7 reprints. Is that right?
Yeah. Is it 7? I don't know. I did hear that it had been reprinted a few times.
Well, so they did something right. And sometimes what we think personally as authors, because we're attached to it, they know their market. They know what kind of covers people are looking. And the fantasy, the countryside fantasy, this appeals very much.
Well, I have been in bookstores where that book was mistakenly shelved with the architecture. An architecture, a book about Japanese architecture, and I'm like, well, no, not really. So I've had to say to the bookstore people, excuse me, I think you need to move this over here. But it is true that, and being hardback and all the rest of it, you know, I think the title did a very nice job, and I'm happy with what they did. It was only just that first second of seeing what was on the front cover, I was like, oh, but that's okay. That's fine.
Rebecca, in the remaining time, go on.
That was just so interesting to hear that process. Thank you.
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you. Rebecca, in the remaining time, can we have one more reading?
Just a second.
I think we're all enjoying hearing you tell your story in your own words, your own voice. It's a treat. It really is.
Because it's summertime and because we're not having these things because of COVID, I want to read about the Bonodori in our area. And this is very short. It's called A Summer Dance. Man, I miss this. Oh, I wish they'd come back. Of course, we haven't had them for 2 years now. Okay, it's called A Summer Dance. There's one night in August that I always look forward to, the night of the Bonodori, the summer dance, honoring the spirits of the dead who have returned briefly to Earth for the Obon Festival. A mini carnival is set up in front of the village hall with the yagura, a kind of wooden tower, erected for the musicians in the center and food and game stalls around the edges of the space. From late afternoon, the shrill sound of the music calls the whole village to come and enjoy the welcome cool breezes and the good cheer of neighbors and relatives. A group of 5 musicians dressed in identical cotton yukata, summer kimono, of a design so traditional it looks modern, have been hired for the evening. 3 rotate on drum, clanging bell, and song, with 2 resting. The lilting words, all on 4 notes, are laced with local references and improvisation. The musicians sing and beat with the skill of long practice. The ones at rest stretch their arms along the yagura struts and gaze out over the crowd. I should tell you that our Obonodori is Goshu Ondo, if that means anything to anybody. There's various songs, and ours is a Goshu Ondo.
Can you translate for us, Rebecca? What is
Goshu,
that?
Ondo, just Goshu is this area, and Ondo means a song. So it's a song of the Kansai of this area. Yeah. Somewhere between Osaka and Nagoya, I would say, people do the Goshu Ondo. Red and white stripes, the symbol of group celebration, wind around the Yagura poles, terminating in the wooden roof, strung with lanterns that glow and sway. Glaring lights mounted on poles illuminate the scene from some angles, but the dancers are constantly moving in and out of shadows, including the deep shadow of the central platform itself. They all dance their own way, and they do it every year. Circling the Yagura, the dancers move to the right, stop and clap, move to the right, stop and clap, on a rhythm of 6 beats, each repetition ending on a different beat of the song. All the old people and most of the younger people take a turn. Small children run back and forth through the circle. Teenagers stand well away from the action, seeming to observe the dance. They are actually directing laser-like glances at the group of opposite sex kids on the other side of the circle. An old man dancing, his spare, jerky movements somehow convey an immense zest for life and tell the story of decades of dancing through good times and bad. Fitting myself into the groove of the dance form, the music is like the needle that hits the groove and calls up the gestures, the stepping and clapping from the memory of last summer. All are in the groove, dancers and musicians, a totality of movement, light, and sound. Around the fringe of the circle are the food and game stalls, each with a tank top clad man lounging on a folding chair, a couple of gazing children, and people striding up self-consciously to avail themselves of the wares. There are mothers squatting to stuff chopsticks full of fried noodles into their children's mouths, genial neighbors laughing over cans of beer, young couples showing off their new babies, 50-ish aunties dressed up as hula dancers, toddlers in frothy cotton kimonos watching the scene all solemn and big-eyed, elder brothers edging toward legal drinking age, sneaking beers in the shadows, and committee members standing importantly with folded arms or striding off in one direction or another. Over it all, the vibrant music, the rubbery stretching and shrinking of the song, proceed to the punctuating boom and click of the drum and the dinging of the bell and the shuffling and claps of the dancers and the hiss of the generator. I've danced here almost every summer of my married life. I've danced in yukata and fancy dress, with my husband and my in-laws, with neighbors I didn't like at all and with friends I was glad to see. I've taught the dance to my sons when they could barely walk and shared a beer with them when they towered over me. But mostly, I've fitted myself into that groove and danced the bongodori, making circuit after circuit, because this is one of the times when I can hold close to my heart the elusive certainty that I too am part of this place. Okay. Nah, I really wish they'd do that again. I wish they would do that again. I love the bongodori.
The elusive certainty that I belong to this place.
Very elusive. Gets more elusive every year.
Yeah.
It's funny. I don't know if other people who've been here a long time, I don't know if it's the same for you, but I feel less acclimatized every year that I live here instead of more. I think, oh, come on. Really? They really do that? And these are things that I've been used to for years. And all of a sudden I'm thinking, nah, I don't like that. That's yucky. It's really kind of strange, no? I'm glad that other people feel that way, though.
Do you think, Rebecca, it's part of the process of growing old in Japan, that part of it is reconciling yourself to this is where I'm at, and this is where I'm going to be? It's part of this, it's a new phase of life to reconcile with?
Well, definitely. I think all of us who are edging, you know, in that direction are feeling that, is this really where I want to stay for the rest of my life? And if not, what do I do? How do I get out? A lot of times, you know, I've felt sort of itchy feet, but at the same time, it's kind of like, I don't really know where I would go. So it's probably better to, you know, stay here with the places and the things that I know. And also, as I was talking about the old ladies, there's a question of usefulness. I think we all want to feel useful. And especially as we get older, the window of usefulness gets smaller and smaller, especially in a Japanese community. These people, they think they know me. They think they have my number. The things that they've decided about me are decades old. I can't change their minds. So it's kind of like, you know, where do I fit in anymore? Now, it's an interesting idea because, you know, you have to think about what you're going to do for however many more years you've got. Sometimes it's a little bit, sometimes it's not, you just don't know. So, yeah, it's, you know, different phase of life, different rhythms, different amounts of knowledge that we have to process. And it's good to have people to talk to, for sure. Yeah.
Rebecca, you said something interesting in the beginning about how you relish your time alone.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, putting Japan aside, you're in a house, you're in a place where you can totally guard that private time. You can, especially even with the family, it's a big house, it's a garden. There's lots of, you can carve out space. You've got your own study, I imagine. And I
do
wonder
and
if there's
got a door on it now.
So I wonder if there's a message for all of us who feel this doubt about growing old. What is the new expression? Aging in place. You heard
aging
that expression?
In place.
aging in place. Mm. And more people in their middle age are now buying homes with that in mind, with barrier free or what, or maybe simpler living, less rooms, whatever it is, aging in place. So
yeah, I can understand that. There used to be a group, they were in the Kansai, I don't know if they were in other parts of Japan, called Bloom Where You're Planted. Maybe that's similar to what you're thinking about. Yeah. Figuring out how to be where you are. And that changes. It changes a lot.
Figuring out.
You know, you have younger kids, you are now a member of the PTA and then blah, 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 shogakko, all that stuff you have to do. And then they get older and now you're a teenager's mother. And then next time, you know, you see them off, you see them married or whatever. And maybe they go somewhere else. You can't see them so much anymore or... And then you come to this place. It's kind of like, I don't want to say backwater because that sounds bad, but it's a kind of a calm area of life where you can sort of take stock and think, okay, what do I really want to do for the next 20 years or however long? Yeah, for the next.
And being a creative person, being somebody who shifts between art and writing, gardening and cooking, you have around you, I would imagine, the things that sustain you, that you're in your happy place.
Well, I have to will myself to do that, especially when it's like now, it's so hot, you know, you don't feel like doing anything, but I have things that I can do for sure. And it's not any kind of a sentence, you know, saying, okay, you have to spend some time at home or you have to stay home. It's like, okay, just give me some art materials and something to write with and I'm fine. I do remember, and I've noticed this when looking at younger people a lot, is that having a whole bunch of choice isn't necessarily a good thing, because you can get very confused about what you want. If there are so many different things available, I'm not saying that it's bad to have so much choice, but I think that some people just get so confused that they just can't move they get paralyzed. And it's a very important, I think, to live a life that you feel is, I don't know how to say this exactly, meaningful maybe. Instead of having so much choice and being able to, because now we can't, right? We don't have as much choice as we had before. Before we could just get on a plane and go wherever we wanted. Now it's much more difficult. And I don't think that those days are going to come back. We'll have to figure out how to age in place. instead of, yeah. You know, and being
this is a beautiful.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, part it's just a part of.
So maybe this is.
That's the rhythm of what's happening now.
So this is a beautiful message in your book, I believe, is being content with what is presented to you in your life and embracing it, accepting it, making it work, and rather than fighting against it. And
well,
so this acceptance.
Yeah, I did hear once somebody, I really don't remember what book this was in because I can't, I wish I could remember. They said that if you can accept your life, it makes you strong because all your energy is moving in the same direction instead of having, various things going this way and that way. What I would like to stipulate though is that it doesn't stay that way. If you decide to do that, if you decide to have that kind of life, it doesn't necessarily stay that way. You can be full of dissatisfaction, in 5 minutes. It's just something that you learn to ride, kind of like riding the surf if you're a surfer. Yeah.
One last question, and then we're gonna wrap up, is that a few years ago, you went to Germany for several months. And how did that feel to leave the house, to be gone for that amount of time?
The part about leaving the house, very fortunately, I had a very, very lovely lady, Sarah Nishina. Let's hear it for Sarah. Woo! All right, a lot of people know her. And her husband said, what are you gonna do about your cat? I said, I don't know. And they said, okay, well, we'll come and stay in your house for 5 months. Well, they were worried about my cat, who is since deceased, but it was so nice of them. They took over my English classes and just kind of basically thought of it as this big adventure. They had my car and just kind of tootled around, and they made friends, really good friends here, and they pointed me towards a lot of things that I hadn't noticed myself about living here. It's like, did you know that there was in the next town, there's a Brazilian grocery? I'm like, really? Where's that? You know, I mean, she's a very adventurous lady. She found all kinds of amazing things that I didn't know existed. So thank goodness for her. But I was worried mainly because it was summertime and I didn't know what would happen to the plants. I kept saying to her, if it doesn't rain over a certain number of days, you have to water this, this, and this. You know, I had all these little instructions, but everything was fine when I got back. It was fine. You know, the amazing thing was when I got back.
Did you miss it, Rebecca?
Yeah. Sorry.
That's the question.
Okay.
Did you miss it?
Question? Did I miss it? Well, I didn't know that I missed it.
Did you miss the house?
I didn't realize that I missed it. Was because when I got back and Sarah picked me up at the airport and she drove me home and I just walked through my house thinking, God damn, this is a beautiful place. It's beautiful here. And outside and in, I was astounded at the beauty of it. I don't say Germany's not beautiful, but it's beautiful in a completely different way. But there were so many things that I just forgot about how I had been living in Japan, living in this other place. And that's something that I would recommend to everybody. Go somewhere for a few months and come back to your house and go, oh my God. It's a wonderful
good advice. Rebecca, if you could tell us a bit about the anthology.
Okay, the Writers in Kyoto group, which was formed not too long ago by John Dougal, who was right here. Hi, John. This is the fourth, I won't say annual because it wasn't really annual. This is the fourth anthology of the people who are members of the Writers in Kyoto group. They're not all based in Kyoto. Some of them are very far away. But the second, third, and fourth anthologies are available. I'm very grateful to everybody involved. If you love Kyoto at all, these anthologies are very interesting to get into the feeling of what it's like to be in this particular city. Yeah? And it's a very valuable group and very valuable books as well.
Minasan, everybody, thank you for your patience. Very exciting and privileged to have Rebecca with us. I'm hoping to inspire conversations from the heart and getting to know authors beyond what's the words on the page, to see how the writing process works for each author and how the collaboration with publishers also changes a book and changes ourselves as we go through it. So this is an opportunity to ask questions and also to get inspired in your journey toward writing a memoir or writing personal essays, because that's where it begins, personal essays. So I wish you all well, and I hope to see you again in the near future. Thanks for joining us tonight.
I believe that everyone has a memoir within waiting to be born, and we can look back on our lives with gratitude and pride for growing beyond the limitations that society and our family background may have put before us, to discover the blessings of a life outside the comfort zone, to share stories that can inspire the friends and family who may not have understood us till now, and the many who have walked in our ways and are much in need of a role model. To call yourself a memoir writer begins the day you commit to telling your story. That's why I started GoshenBooks.com, to provide you with the tools and the incentive to complete your memoir. Get private coaching directly from me. One session can give you the focus you need, and regular weekly sessions will keep you on track to keep you motivated, accountable, and confident that your story matters, your life matters. You've got what it takes. Now go for it. Finish your book. Read the testimonials, the reviews, and sign up at GoshenBooks.com.